Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 193 for the end of the year 2010. My, how time flies. I mean, I feel like it was just the beginning of the year and thinking, oh, what are we going to do this year? Anyway, thanks for joining me. Thanks for being there. I got to tell you something before we even get into our first guest, our only guest, actually, the guy that you've been waiting for and the only person I would have as the end of year guest, Frank Curzio. I want to let you know that I really appreciate all the support, the emails, the friendship, and all the things that you've shown me over the last number of years on this podcast and the other ones that we host. And thanks so much for all your kind words and everything there, because we do this for you. Recently, somebody asked, why do we do this? Well, we kind of like doing this. It's the fun part of the job, if you will. It's fun part of what we do, sharing some of the knowledge, information, having this conversation. And really, if you think about it, developing a worldwide friendship with people. We have people listening all over the world. Big fan base, it seems, in Germany. Hey, Germany! Also in Japan and Australia. So thank you so much. I wish you, before we begin, a wonderful, wonderful holiday season. A really great time, hopefully, you're spending with family and friends. And, of course, a prosperous 2011. So, what are we going to talk about today? I want to bring Frank Curzio on because, besides the fact he's my best bud and the fact that I really enjoy his discussions, everybody always says, every single time that he comes on, wow. That was a great podcast because Frank doesn't hold back. It's not like he's worried about what he's saying. He doesn't worry about, you know, who he's either trashing or building up in terms of stocks and markets and things like that. And we have a lot of things I want to go over about what happened last year and what we're looking forward to potentially next year. So the new daddy is here. Frank, how are you, bub?
Good. How's it going, bud?
Oh, it's going really well. Thank you. And, you know, I know you moved to Florida for the warm weather. How was that the last few weeks?
It's been cold.
It's been unbelievable.
It's amazing, actually, because I came down here and my family was like, why are you going down to Florida for? You know, it's too hot down there. And it was more hot in New York this year than it was in Florida in some instances. And then because I'm in northern Florida. And then, you know, I'm like, well, I'm going to a safer area. And I actually, you know, I started surfing. I parked my car on a beach, a very safe beach, and someone jumped in my car and tried to rob me. So nice. Maybe I should just go back to New York.
Yeah, but if you were in New York, they would have robbed you and mugged you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, pretty much that's true.
By the way, before we begin, you know, you were in New York, and I used to live out in Suffolk County. You live where, in Queens?
In Queens, yeah.
Did you ever live in Nassau?
Yes, I did.
Did you see the story about Nassau County may have to be, I printed it here somewhere, I don't know if you saw this, but there was a story about Nassau County, Long Island. Is it here? Yeah. And this, I guess, dovetails onto the whole issue with Meredith Whitney coming on recently and talking about the municipal failures that may be happening over the next year. It says Nassau County, New York moves closer to state fiscal control. I guess this is because of the fact that there was a problem with, obviously, just like California, them meeting their bills. This is a very affluent area in New York, right? And they're having problems. Do you believe there is this whole potential overriding issue about the municipalities and the failures going into maybe 2011, 2012?
Well, let me start off with Nassau County. Nassau County, that's in Long Island, has been an absolute disaster. It'll cost you about $450,000 to buy a shack and have property where maybe you could fit a grill and a patio table and pay about $12,000 in taxes on average. Mm-hmm. It's not worth it at all. You sit in traffic every day. However, that area, they just spent money unbelievably, and they were in huge debt before the crisis. After the crisis, they decided, hey, you know, we're not bringing enough revenue, but we're still going to spend. So it has been a nightmare for Nassau County and people who live there. If you think your taxes are high now, wait, they're probably going to be 25% higher in the next 5 years.
They keep raising them.
So
nice.
Getting to your question on municipalities, look, you know, I say things like you said, I really don't hold back. Meredith Whitney's been wrong for a while, and she deserves a lot of credit for what she called Citigroup. I think it was a fantastic call, and I'm a big fan of
hers. Wait. I'm going to interrupt you. Back up. What did she call with Citigroup? She called basically that they were going to have to stop their dividend. That was a good call.
That was a good call. That was an amazing call at the time because there's 25 analysts that cover the stock, and not one of them saw it, sending her hate mail saying that she's absolutely crazy. I just thought that for you to really go out there and say what she did at that time was an amazing call. I think she's a fantastic analyst. Now, you have to realize Meredith Whitney is great at one thing. She's great at marketing herself. So when you go on to 60 Minutes, you can't say, well, I think we're going to see defaults in the municipals 5 years from now. You know what? Because people are going to shut the program off because they don't care what happens 5 years from now. So she says this is going to happen in 12 months. Guys, it's not going to happen in 12 months, and I hate saying this, but the federal government is going to bail it. They're not going to bail out AIG and let California fail. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
Plus, they're under the impression right now, since they made money on Citigroup, since they made money bailing out the banks, that they could actually make money doing this. So they're going to continue to spend. It's terrible for the country longer term. But these problems are not going to hit in 2011. That's why you're seeing Goldman Sachs, you're seeing these investment firms, you're seeing everybody saying, wow, what an environment for stocks where the government is actually creating a place where it's terrible to invest almost any place else except for the stock market, and that's what's happening in 2011. So I know it's exciting to say the municipality is going to fail, and they're an enormous amount of debt. We know the numbers. We calculate the numbers, too, as Stansberry Associates, and my boss is a big believer of the end of the world going to happen, but I just don't see it in 2011. I think, and it's scary when you look at the statistics, but again, in the short term, it's not going to hit in the short term, and I think it's not going to hit in Europe as well, because they're going to bail out Spain, they're going to bail out Portugal. They already said that they're going to do that, and I think that's going to happen in short term because they can get away with it right now. We're going to see the consequences for this longer term.
Yeah, that's the point. All right, one thing I have to say before we go any further, and you're going to have to do this. You ready? You're popping your peas. Move your microphone. It's killing me.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I have a pet peeve about popping peas.
Okay,
that was great. Now, there was a lot of them in there. I counted 42. I'll have to edit them afterwards, actually. Okay. All right, so let's talk about what happened and this is right on the same subject. Let's talk about, just for a second, because this is end of year, what happened and what happened in 2010. So here's a setup. So I think the biggest issue that happened was that nothing happened. In other words, Greece kind of was upsetting, and Dubai was the beginning, and we had the euro getting hurt, and then we had issues like you say the municipalities. But I think the theme that I would have to say that was the overriding theme throughout the whole year was the government and their intervention, rescue, bailout, and their safety net below things that did two things. Number one, it accelerated the ability for companies to clean up balance sheets and for them to then do their best to shore up earnings, if you will. The second thing was it allowed for the economy not to continue in a tailspin because obviously a lot of unemployment benefits, et cetera, so that retail did very well. And then beyond that, it was the emerging markets that really kicked up and then kind of came full circle to help the United States, et cetera. Europe is still over there in a mess, in my opinion. So aside from that, aside from the government assistance, which I'm not saying that in a bad way, I'm not using that as a bad word because it is what it is. What else was kind of like what you saw through 2010 as that was right in front of your face? That was like, wow, that's really what happened.
I think we all underestimated. I think you nailed it on the head. We all underestimated how much the government could actually inflate this market. And how much they could actually change the market. And you can't really go against the Fed here when they're just printing money like crazy and bailing out everybody and just, same in Europe as well. And I think, the forecast for 2010, we talked about this in early 2010. We didn't think we'd finish the year at this pace. However, in the middle, you kind of saw it. And if there's one thing I can explain to the people listening to this podcast is don't be stubborn in your investments, because especially men get very stubborn as they get older. Every old man that I know, I hope I don't get that way. My dad's been, my late dad, everybody I know seems to get stubborn. if the facts change, you have to be able to change. And that's what happened mid-year, where at the beginning of the year, you weren't too sure if, you know, the quantitative easing was going to take place, if it did take place, what effect it would have, if interest rates were going to stay low. Remember, everybody thought interest rates were going to be much, much higher at this time 12 months ago, and they're not. They're still low. They're starting to trend higher, but they're still relatively low, even mortgage rates. So I think when you underestimated that, and then you see, wait a minute, that the government is able to inflate this market. They're able to push these problems down the road, and it's very, very good for stocks. They're able to like you said, rebalance, restructure their balance sheets. They're also, their productivity chain has been absolutely fantastic now, where they don't have huge inventories anymore. And all of this is transferred into very much higher profits, less debts for these companies. And on a corporate level, you know, not talking from Main Street, we talk about Wall Street here. On a corporate level, these companies have been are in the best shapes that they've ever been in terms of balance sheets and cash in history since I've been looking at stocks. And you know, is it because of the government? Yes, absolutely. A lot of this is because of the government. But you know, you could sit in a corner and say, I can't stand this. This is ridiculous. Or you can get into the market and figure out who's going to benefit from this.
You know, on that note, I think that here's a question I want to ask you and ponder for a moment. Do you think it's possible that due to our generation, our age, in other words, where we are, you're a little bit younger than I am, but where we are, we never saw, even in the 70s, we never saw such an incredible amount of government desire that they will pump up at any cost, really, at any cost, and frankly, at any long-term cost also. And that was a disadvantage for anyone that's younger than, say, 70 or 80, seriously. Mm-hmm. Because if you were 70 or 80 or so, you may have seen what happened back in the, you know, well, maybe it'd be 90, I guess. You'd see what have happened in, you know, back in the 20s and 30s and things of that nature and that time period. And maybe that's what did happen for a while then. And if you did have that ability to understand that. And it wasn't just by looking at what happened. You would have had to experience it, I think. So do you think that was kind of a disadvantage because we were maybe thinking, and when I say we, it's the collective we of all of us listening, that we said, hey, you know what? Maybe there is, in the beginning we said, maybe the government will do what it can, but it will be at the same time responsible for the future. When in reality, they said, we can't think about the future. We have to think about now. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes. I think all that goes to mainstream media as well, where, you know, we want you can get information within seconds around the entire world. You never really had that before. You know, in today's time, with our government right now, you know, of course, everyone knows the saying, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And nobody wants to say, okay, enough's enough. I mean, the Republicans are in, and they believe that they're going to have, you know, a great economy, but yet cut spending. It's impossible statistically, mathematically. It's impossible.
Wait a minute. So they think that's the fact in Greece. Did I miss something?
No, but I know it's true. But you know, I mean, they're going to take office. They're like, all right, there's too much government spending, but yet they believe that the market's going to go higher, and people really look at the market and say, hey, you know, if I feel richer, then that's good for the economy. And yes, it's hurting Obama's numbers, don't get me wrong, but Obama's not going to say, okay, enough with the spending, that's it, and really let this market come down and some of these businesses fail. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Our political system is structured that, hey, what could I do for you today? And they want to make sure that they're going to bail out as many people as they can, or this way the economy stays on solid grounds. And it's a shame because looking down the road, and you know, I think Ron Paul could be pretty much out there sometimes, but he brings up a lot of good points that are pretty scary out there. If you're looking at our fiscal deficit and where we're going, I mean, guys, eventually, you know, we got to settle our debts. We just can't keep spending money and spending money and extending benefits. What is it? How many people are on food stamps now? 40 million people on food stamps.
Yeah,
and food prices are going higher. So what's going to happen? And they're going to be able to pay for that. And, you know, unemployment benefits, you know, mortgages. People bought houses they can't afford. We're trying to keep them in these houses that they can't afford. It doesn't make sense. So eventually we're going to have to take our medicine. But unfortunately, with our political system, it's, okay, let's just keep pushing it down the road because this way we'll stay in office. And it's going to be interesting to see in the next election what happens. Will Obama get reelected? How the economy is going to be doing? Because that president that comes in is really going to be in a lot of trouble.
Right.
So, you know, I to be honest with you, I wouldn't want to be president of the country in that cycle. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
So, you know, the distinction that was made last year about Wall Street versus Main Street, you know, let's change that because the Wall Street was the theoretical banks, right? That was the bankers and the banks and all that. It's really corporate America street versus Main Street right now. And that's where that dichotomy is, where the unemployment rate in a way helps the corporate America because of the, you know, the excessive costs that don't have to be paid to employees. And the fact that, you know, at the same time, there's so many people unemployed and so many problems and you know, businesses that are out of business, et cetera. I had a conversation with Jeff Rosen over at briefing.com yesterday. He's one of the lead economists over there. Great guy. And I talked about the theory about, you know, what's happening right now in terms of the employment situation. What's the real rate of unemployment that seems to be what everybody wants to get to? Because we know that the dual mandate of the Fed is partially to keep, one of the parts of the dual mandate is to keep employment at what is supposed to be the, you know, full employment ratio, which right now economists are thinking is somewhere around 4.9%. Now, he's saying that doesn't seem at all right, that full employment in the United States going on into the future is maybe 6.5% or so because of, you know, changes in the dynamic of what we do here, technology, and just the use of exported service and manufacturing. And so you have that going to it. And I think there's a lot of negative vibes out there due to the unemployment situation. And I also think, and I agree with you, that, you know, when you look at the economy looks good. Well, comparatively from a year ago, 2 years ago, it looks fantastic, first of all. Second of all, there are components of the economy that are very ugly. The housing market, generally speaking, is horrible. Unemployment is horrible. But then you look at other things and you look at manufacturing, looks very much improved. You look at things like the overall numbers when it comes to anything about consumer confidence, really good. As a matter of fact, the highest it's been in a couple of years. So when you look at durable goods, you look at all of this, when you look at that, retail sales generally looks okay. I mean, I'm not saying it's a booming economy, but it doesn't look very sluggish either, right?
No, and it's going to get better next year.
Right.
I think the economic data is going to get better next year. And for those of you listening to this, and we talk about the economy. We love the economy. We talk about it every day. Some people, you know, yawn when they hear the economy. I love the economy. I think it's about everything that we do, everything we buy for sale signs across the street. But as far as looking at the data, unemployment used to be a big deal to me. If you're looking at it in terms of stocks, it's not an important data point anymore. I mean, unemployment's been 10%. What has that done for stocks? Nothing. Stocks are what? 52-week, 2-year highs. So I think as long as unemployment doesn't get worse, and I don't see it getting worse, I don't see it getting much better either. But I think if we stay between 9%, 9.5%, or, you know, 8.5% to 9.5%, I don't think that's going to be you could take anything out of the unemployment and translate that into where stocks are going to go. Now, if these people do get their jobs, it's not an indication that, oh, we're going to see more spending, because you're not really going to see spending from that group of people that do get jobs because, you know, they've been unemployed. Plus, look at, like you said, the retail sale numbers. They're on fire. The people who have jobs are spending like crazy. And a lot has to do with sentiment. It's not so much that things are so much better today than they were 12 months ago. The stock market's better. Unemployment's not really better, right? I mean, people aren't getting paid more, right? We're not getting bonuses like you got in 2007. So it has a lot to do with sentiment, and sentiment's greater, and you're seeing spending. Now, in 2011, I think sentiment's going to be very important because if you have positive sentiment and that's what they're inflating into the market, they're trying to create an inflationary environment, you're going to continue to see these trends tick higher. I think you're going to see retail sales do well. You probably see a slowdown, obviously, after Christmas and after the holiday season. But I think manufacturing is going to be good. If you're looking at the emerging markets are absolutely on fire, I think you're going to see continued growth from that area. You mentioned Europe, and I'm going to say something today. Europe is not a terrible place. The euro is terrible. But if you listen to conference calls, I've listened to a lot of conference calls, Europe isn't really doing that bad. They're showing sales. I mean, you see
hold the comments. Hold it.
I know you're going to be against me.
I'm not. I'm going to be totally with you, except for one point. You ready? Germany's doing good. Europe stinks. Continue.
Not. It's not just Germany. You got other areas as well. I mean, you're looking at some of the places that are doing absolutely horrible. It's fine. But if you listen to the conference calls, they are seeing demand. You're seeing an economy grow 1-1.5%. May seem slow. We're talking about a mature economy, though. It's not negative. We're not seeing recessionary. Now, the euro is absolutely terrible because you have some of these countries on the euro. They can't inflate their markets like we could. They can't create more money. They shouldn't be on the euro standard, but they are. And that's really what's troubling. I'm not saying Europe is great. I'm just saying Europe is not terrible. I don't think it's as terrible as everyone is saying, because you're seeing, and again, this I base what I know from listen to the conference calls absolutely for free from the largest companies, large manufacturing companies, and they say, you know what, Europe is flat. We're seeing 2-3% growth. It's not like, oh, man, Europe is terrible. We're looking to get out of there. It's not necessarily right. That.
I agree. But here's my point. Europe is okay because it's not going over a cliff right now in terms of, let's call consumption. Let's just say consumption in general, okay? And therefore, the companies that are – there's two things. There's companies that are already doing business there are not saying, okay, we're running from the hills. We're getting out of here, okay? Because obviously, they're doing okay. The second thing, though, is that there's companies that are trying to get into Europe now have never been there before. You know, like I think as a good example is Chipotle. You know, they got a bunch of chains last year and they started getting into Europe and all that. That's incrementally better because they have – it's like – you know, an expansion, if you will, to a new market. So there, it wasn't there before. It is there now. So that's good for them. But on the other hand, do you necessarily think that the companies inside of Europe that have been there, that have relied on European consumption, all that, are that solid? Do you think that's – and the banks? I mean, I just don't see that. I see – outside companies doing better there. I see Germany. I'm obviously saying Germany's okay, but German companies, frankly, because they export excessively. But I just don't see many of the other areas doing as well. And I do see some benefit for U.S. based and other based companies that are doing business and expanding into Europe. And I can respect that. I just don't see how the whole European thing gets settled. And it just, you know, because they're not going to reinflate. And if our economy is growing because of governmental intervention, a massive amount of money into it, and they're not doing that there. How do they then? Are you saying that they're that much better than us that they don't need any of that?
No, I'm not saying that they're in better shape than us at all. I'm just saying that it's not as terrible as everybody thinks because everyone said, you know, the euro. But we just read the headlines of how terrible the euro is. We hear about, you know, the pigs nations and how terrible they are, and you know, we see credit default swaps trading at obscene levels where it looks like Spain and Portugal are going to get bailouts, and that area as well. Like you said, Germany's doing pretty good, but you know, according to the companies I'm listening to, it's not a disaster area that everyone's predicting. Where they say, oh, you know, it's so funny because some people just say, okay, Europe's going to collapse probably in 2011. Then we have 2012. I'm like, Europe's not going to collapse. The euro may collapse pretty soon. It doesn't look good for a lot of people on that standard. But just Europe in general, I think, is really you have a lot of people coming out extremely negative on it. But if you really look back, take a look at the facts, it's not absolutely terrible. I'm not saying that it's good. I'm not saying that it's great. I'm just saying that it's not as terrible as everybody thinks.
Okay, can we agree on this? Can we agree on this point? It's the worst out of the major economies.
Of course. Okay. Oh, no. Japan's worse.
All right. I'll give you that. Actually, Barry Ritholtz, I saw him last night on some program. I think it may have been Fast Money or something I was glancing through. And he was actually bullish on Japan because of,
QE,
I guess,
probably, right?
It wasn't really so much QE. It was just how bad it is. And I don't know. It was like kind of a weird. It was almost like just a let's find the weirdest contrarian call and say it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you know what? If you're a believer in 2011, people say, well, large caps are going to outperform. If Goldman Sachs is right and S&P is going to go up 19% next year, you don't want to own large caps. In bull markets, the worst place you could be is large caps. You want to be in the small, risky areas because those are going to easily outperform. So I see where Ritholtz is going if he says, well, let's go with Japan because Japan has been terrible for such a long time. If you're really seeing like a global market that everyone's anticipating to do good, it's probably better to take the – it's almost like if you like a specific industry, if you want the greatest returns, buy the worst company.
Oh yeah.
Or if you want to be safe, buy the best company in case you're wrong and decline. So I see where he's going with it, and it's been bad for such a long time. Yeah, I can see his point.
So 2010, I think the biggest surprise was the I think we both agree with the amount and the absolute fortitude and non-wavering level of government stuff. Let's just say stuff. You know, use a George Carlin word, stuff, that they've done. And I also think that going into 2011, and you know, everybody, I get emails when I start talking about things that are good because everybody wants to kind of think about all the bad a lot of times. You know, am I wildly bullish? I mean, you know, I am reality here, okay? Here's the reality that we're going to get a 2% reduction in the payroll tax. Folks, where's that going to go? 2% reduction in the payroll tax for an employee is going to go into spending. You know, you want to say some of it's saving, some of it's going to be debt reduction. Okay, great. But that is in itself. Take away, in my opinion, take away everything else. Take away the $600 billion QE2, which I want to talk about in a minute. That is a tremendous stimulus for the economy. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I agree 100%.
I mean, that money just drops right to the bottom line.
Yes.
It's immediate. It's not like you have to wait to your tax return or something like that. The only other thing that I've always talked about that would be really cool to do would be to put a rebate on gasoline or just reduce the taxes, because that's like a weekly, just like your paycheck. It's a weekly thing that you have to pay, and all of a sudden your paycheck goes from $1,000 to, let's say, $1,015. I'm just taking that number. Well, that's $15. $20.
No, it's true. It comes to the point where, and we're all falling into, it's not necessarily a trap, but we're seeing how we could stimulate the economy. When we announce a stimulus, that's money that we have to pay back. And I think some people don't realize that. And if you're looking at our federal deficit, it's actually the highest level, just to put in perspective, a person, I want to thank my boss, Porter Stansberry, for this, but it's the equivalent of every American being in debt for $140,000. That's how much debt we're in, $140,000. Think about that for each person, each American. That's how much debt we have. So, you know, if we're extending the Bush tax cuts, hey, that's another trillion that we're going to have to pay back. It's not enough revenue coming in, and we have bills to pay. Right. So, you know, if you're looking at it, yeah, again, there's so many different things you could do right now, because it's all fun and games. Everyone's having a party. You know, like you said, sometimes people get upset, especially people on Main Street, when you're saying, well, I think stock's going to do good this year. And, you know, some of these people may not have a job, and they're having trouble. And you understand that. But what the government is doing right now is just something that they've never done in the history of this market, where they're just inflating. They're making people feel a lot richer than they are. We avoided a complete meltdown of our entire banking system, and we fixed a problem in what, 6 months? Are you kidding me? No way.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're looking at the balance sheets and everything, especially the banks, which they're not even, you know, you still can't really read. But, again, right now, it's just, it does set up for stocks as well in 2011. It's just, you know, I'm really afraid for my kids coming like 2000. Where are we going to be 5 years from now?
Well, what do you think? The other thing is that, you know, the other thing about 2010 into 2011, we'll see if this changes, but the volume, the movements, and it doesn't necessarily have to be related to, let's say, volatility per se on a massive basis, but it seems very apparent that there is the ability with a small amount of money through futures, ETFs, etc., to move large blocks of asset prices. Currency transactions, in my opinion, have been the overriding towards the year end of 2010 have been the overriding action in the markets. Do you agree with that? I mean, that it's almost like the currency on the euro and the yen has been the absolute mover of markets.
Yeah, major mover. And like you said, low volume, it's easier to move these stocks. And I'm going to share with you, see with me, I guess a lot of people like to come on and tell you how they have the 1,000% winners all the time. With me, I always like to tell you the mistakes I made. This way I can learn, everyone else can learn. And one of the major mistakes I made in 2010 is I have stop losses on all my stocks because I manage stocks under 10 small cap stocks. And you need to. They absolutely have to have stop losses, because if you did in 2008, you completely wiped out and you missed a huge rebound in 2009, 2010. You always want to protect your wealth. And my stop losses were actually too tight, where I got stopped out of a lot of stocks in August when we had that 6% decline to S&P. We saw some stocks decline, small cap stocks decline 30% just because the market came down. Had nothing to do with the stock specifically. Those stocks that I got stopped at are at 52-week highs, 100% higher. So my point is, next year, I'm forecasting, and I think you believe the market's going to go higher. A lot of people think the market's going to go higher. It is going to be very choppy. Right now, almost every sentiment indicator I look at is screaming for you to be into stocks, which usually is a contrarian indicator, which usually tells you that, we're expecting a pullback. We're going to see massive move. By the end of 2011, we're going to be we finished the year, I believe the S&P is up 12%. We declined 6, 7% in August, and we finished this year in up 12%, just about in the S&P 500. So I think we're going to finish the year probably 5, 7% higher than the S&P 500. That's normally a bullish forecast. If you look at the past 20 years,
right.
If you look at the past 2 years, that's not really that bullish.
Yeah.
But I think that's a bullish forecast. My point is, don't be fully invested in the market, because you're going to have opportunities to buy your favorite stocks down 20%. I think it's going to be that choppy. I think you're going to see huge whipsaws, people running to the exits. You're going to see, you know, the headlines flashing, here it is, a debt problems, or, you know, when Spain gets bailed out or whatever it is, you're going to get the opportunity. I don't believe that you need to pay for premiums for stocks in 2011. I think you could sit on it. You could be patient. If companies miss quarters, you're going to see 20, 25% declines easily. If they make the quarter, you'll probably see a 5% rise. I really think that's the type of environment for 2011. And the companies that do come down on those huge reactions, I think are going to be incredible buying opportunities. So try to make a list of stocks that you would buy, your favorite stocks that you would buy 25% lower. And when this market comes back, use that to go into the markets, because there's a ton of people out there that I believe there's a bottom to this market where we're going to see pullbacks, but there's just so much money that wants to come into this market right now. I think it's going to really push these stocks back higher.
Well, especially with the low cost of funds, and that's why the currency market is saying, playing such a tremendous part in this. You know, you have the government that's doing all sorts of manipulation. I don't say that necessarily in a negative way, but a manipulation of the markets in terms of buying in of treasuries and of throwing in stimulus and, you know, movement of the currency markets. And all of that is something that plays a big role. And when you have these carry trades that go on, and when you're buying and selling currencies and then reinvesting it into equities and moving it in and out and end of year and beginning of year movements, I mean, it's very much exacerbated. So I agree with you with that. You know, 25% lower is a pretty interesting number, but that's how you play it. And I respect that in terms of especially the small caps that do come back with that. I think that, you know, the question always is when to get out, when to get in, but that's for another whole discussion. In terms of the all of this relating to commodities, one of the things that has been coming up lately is the idea that, you know, obviously we're seeing a lot of commodity movement, even as dollars moves higher, they're still seeing oil move higher, gold move higher, generally speaking, copper, rubber, et cetera. What is your feeling on these commodity ETFs? For example, there's a lot of talk that there's going to be an aluminum ETF out there, right? So naturally, it should at least naturally move the prices of aluminum higher, because it doesn't have to, but there's going to be an initial move because there'll be money that can be invested in aluminum that was really never able to be invested before, right? You could use Alcoa or a few others, but the actual commodity. Do you think this is a good thing or a bad thing, or is it meaningless?
I don't think it's meaningless, but I could tell you, for our perspective, I don't really like ETFs, because I like going into individual companies. I don't think the ETFs, any ETFs, really track what they're supposed to track. Maybe the larger ones like the S&Ps and the Russells, but if you're looking for like index ETFs, you know, like the Junior Miner Gold Index, Junior Miner is identified as gold, speculative gold companies under, you know, market cap of 100 million, and they have like billion-dollar companies in there. You know, so if you're really looking, I mean, you're looking at some of the biotech ETFs, and they'll have 40% in one position in Amgen. So if you're looking at ETFs, be sure, even if you go on Yahoo Finance and you do like, you know, you do a profile search and they'll give you like the holdings and everything, be sure you look at those holdings, even the home builder ETFs, because they'll have Bed Bath & Beyond in the home builder ETF. They'll have, you know, just it's not just Home Depot and the home builders. It's just, you know, it's just crazy what they actually put into these ETFs. With that, it's not going to make for great tracking. So for me, ETFs really don't work for me. I don't like them. Sometimes I'll buy an ETF as a hedge, like an S&P ETF, like SH, which is a one-time short, not a two- or three-time short, which, you know, if I think the market's going to come down, I'll protect myself. I think they're great for that. But, you know, as far as ETFs are concerned, you really have to do your homework on them, because they don't really – what they say and what they do is just two totally different things.
So, but aside from investing in the ETF, what's your thought on the fact of an ETF itself – that is a new ETF, again, not from an investment standpoint in the ETF, but how that moves the commodity market?
Well, we saw what GLD and what they could do to actually move the market. What you're saying, the aluminum one's going to come out. So could they move the markets? Absolutely. You're going to see so much inflows coming into that compared to just regular stocks. So yeah, obviously, I think it would move the commodity. It could move some of these stocks a lot higher, a lot lower, and it's easier to put money into there, especially for the hedge funds. But yeah, I mean, if that's a question you're asking, yeah, I mean, I know GLD, we've seen, you know, do they actually store the gold? And we've seen so many different comments come out on the ETFs, especially in the commodities. But to me, look, they're getting you know, I'm not a big fan of buying the ETF commodities, and I do think that they're bad for the commodities, if that's the question that you're asking.
Yeah, I just want, because it does seem to me that by creating an aluminum ETF, it pushes the price of the commodity even higher artificially. So the commodity price is no longer based on usage and demand. It's based on purely speculation in that particular ETF.
Yeah, but is commodities ever based on, I mean, not ever, but right now, are they really based on demand? I mean, well, is copper at an all-time high because of demand, because people are buying more houses?
I don't know, but it's because of China's stockpiling and because J.P. Morgan owns 80% of it or something like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're stockpiling, but a lot of it is people are using this as a hedge. Maybe, you know, our currency, inflation. I mean, people are buying commodities. People aren't buying gold necessarily because of supply and demand. They're buying it because they think that, you know, we're going to see a collapse in our currency. So, you know, it depends, like, the reasonings why you're buying these commodities, but I'd argue that commodities aren't high. Yeah, I've been to China. I know how big that boom is. And, you know, it's enormous. Inland China, people don't understand that story, how big and how much of a growth engine. It's not Shanghai and Beijing. People love to complain about the property markets. Guys, you know, you could stay there, you could do all you want. That's not China's story. China's story is inland. All those companies, they're moving inland, which means more jobs are being created in China. And you know, you look at our major economies, it's not that, you know, when the U.S. grew, when Japan and Europe, when we grew and salaries became to and salaries moved higher, what do we do with jobs? Well, we move them to places like China, to places like Vietnam. Well, in China, what they're doing, they're taking jobs and they're keeping them in China, which is amazing, because that's showing that the entire economy is growing. It's almost like you're giving, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to Detroit, to you know, Florida, to build up their markets, and it's really strengthening the U.S. So, you know, that's a story there. As far as the commodities go, I'd argue that, hey, it's not necessarily demand, but like you said, you know, people just hoarding it, and I don't think people are building more houses. It's not why copper is at an all-time high. It's not why cotton's at an all-time high. It's not why gold and silver at all-time highs. I think it's just people are nervous, and that's the area of the market to be in right now.
I don't know. My understanding of cotton is a little bit more about the requirement, droughts and things of that nature, but also the requirement of China. China's in every discussion here. Let's talk about China. I know you were very bullish on it, or have been very bullish. I know that China's is continually being really bearish. China's been in a bit of a funk, you know, up and down recently. We're talking about the Shanghai Index. We're talking about the markets there. Clearly, we know that there is the continuation of infrastructure build-out, amazing amount of growth for the middle class in China. Any kind of hiccups that you may see? I mean, the whole idea that they're trying to hold back the economy because the record amount of housing sales and speculation on real estate and the overheating of their economy in terms of their last inflation reading being 5.1%, their CPI above 6 and change, their PPI above 6 and change. What's your thought about any, you know, problems, or is it just like, you know, that's the way it is and it's, you know, kind of rolling along?
No, the problems are going to be an inflationary end, if anything. What's amazing about China is that when it comes to their government, and this isn't going to sound crazy because everyone says, oh, you know, they're corrupt and there is a lot of corruption there. But these guys go into a room, Andrew, it's like you and I go into a room and say, you know what, the economy is becoming inflated. Let's just, cut the lending for banks. And we walk out of the room, press a button, and all the banks are like, okay, we have to cut lending right now. You know, that doesn't happen here. It takes like 18 months, 24 months, all arguing. It's in the newspapers. It's not like that. So China could turn on their policy like a light switch, which is great for the economy. So it's easy for them to control inflation or try to control inflation. I think the growth there is absolutely enormous, which is taking place, but it's going to be a very choppy market. You're going to see price fluctuations. I mean, even the stocks I recommended last time, you've seen them. I want to say a lot of them are higher, but you've seen like 20, 30% moves. You see these back and forth. And that's, you know, goes back to my thesis for 2011. Guys, if you like stocks, especially in China, be patient, because believe me, they'll come down to your buy price and you'll get a chance to buy these things, because sometimes when they take off, they just take off 50, 60, 70% in 2-3 months and it's too high. You know, it almost forced you to be a trader. But I think the growth engine's there. I mean, you're talking about an economy that's growing at near 10%. I mean, forget about the statistics today. It's growing at least 10%. And you know, you're looking over here where we're struggling to grow 2.5%. You're looking at Europe 1.5%. Every single manufacturing company, large cap manufacturing company in the U.S., if you listen to the conference calls, are opening plants in China in 2011. And think about that.
That's good for them. It's good for China, but again, it's lousy for our unemployment situation.
Absolutely,
here.
But it also. But you know, the point is that these guys have the best economists. These are not economists from Washington, where you know you're there for 4 years, no matter how terrible you are. If these guys are wrong, they lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. And all these economists for these companies, all these big large manufacturing companies in the U.S. are saying, guys, you better get into China right now. China's enormous. So they're all building plants. They're all taking advantage of this. So you know, the growth there is for real. As for the stock prices, you have to be patient. You're seeing a lot of news come out where they are cracking down on reverse mergers, and you know, for you,
well, those have been kind of ugly on some of those stocks. I mean, those
stocks have come down, but it's just funny when you hear it. And I'm not like, you know, an advocate for China and buy China everything. You know, there's some stocks that really come to reverse merger market, and what that is, you know, you don't come up to the market in an IPO. Really, you're taking over a shell company and just changing it, and the costs are nearly nothing to do so. So it's 100% legal practice. But there's a lot of crackdowns, and there's a lot of companies that are actually phony. So yeah, you know, I see it coming. You know, I see where you know we're going to regulate this. But you know, while they're doing this, it's just going to strengthen China even more. So I think that it's good that they're cracking down on this. This way, we could actually read these financials and not listed it in Chinese and all over the place where we can't read the financials and balance sheets. But I think overall, yeah, I do like China. I think it's a huge growth engine, and I'm going to follow the corporations there. And I think that there's incredible opportunities, but be patient.
Yep. Let's talk about banks. It appears that towards the end of 2010, there was an amazing rotation out of many of the stocks that really were the leaders throughout the year, many of the growth-related stocks, those like the Netflix and Chipotle. And, you know, you could talk about even maybe not so much Apple, but you know the kind of the players, if you will, into very simply the bank stocks. I mean, we had out of nowhere towards the end of the year just an amazing change of hands, it seemed, between what were the leaders and the losers in the last couple of weeks. Now, the question is it simply a rotation from taking profits on your best positions from the institutions, et cetera, mutual funds, and rotating it into the least profitable and the worst performers of the year? Or is there actually something going on vis-a-vis maybe the yield curve steepening to incredible levels that are actually helping the banks? Or is it a combination?
I don't know. It's a good question. I'm a big fan of banks at certain prices. I know it sounds funny, but for me, it's very difficult to read the balance sheets of especially large cap bank. I don't know anybody that can.
Difficult? Come on. It's impossible.
You just can't. Yeah, they forget about stuff it. Off balance
let's say this. Let's clear this up. The fact is that you would have to be one of the most incredible forensic accountants that knew really what they were doing to understand balance sheets of these banks, right? Would you
absolutely
agree?
Yeah, absolutely. So my advice, I actually have a bank in my newsletter is called Penny Stock Specialist Portfolio, and I actually recommend Citigroup, which is not a penny stock, but it's under $5 stock. And the reason why I recommend this is I told people that I believe there's 50% upside. And, you know, I knew the government would sell at stake, which means the company could buy back stock. Institutional ownership will go higher, which is 25% less than its competitors like JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America. Once the government stake is gone and the government's no longer in the company, I knew institutions are going to flow into here. But the key measure that I looked at is tangible book value. And the tangible book value for Citigroup was $4.05. And the company fell below that. And once I saw that, I thought that was an incredible buying opportunity. Because again, it's very difficult to read everything. But that, and plus, if you look at the momentum over the last 7 quarters for Citigroup, it's been positive. Lower delinquency rates, they're going to have earnings for the foreseeable future. Every single quarter over the last 7 quarters have been positive. Mm-hmm. So they continue to trend higher. That, and as soon as it fell below tangible book value, I used the opportunity to buy at $3.85, I believe. Now, if you're looking at tangible book value for JP Morgan and Wells Fargo, they're like 50% lower than where they're trading. You probably will never get the opportunity. But Bank of America's tangible book value is $11.10. And for anyone listening, just pull up the chart, because it fell below that level for a couple of days. And look what happened. The stock's like $13.50. And you're seeing like I think that's a great indicator. It's something you have to be patient with, because it doesn't happen often. But when these banks, the large caps, and even you can go to mid cap level, when they trade below tangible book value, almost to the point where they could be liquidated at, if they could be liquidated, we're not talking about goodwill, which is a guess. We're talking about what their assets are actually worth. If they're worth $13 and the stock's trading for $12, it's almost like a steal at the price. And that's what I have at Bank of America. And you saw a whole bunch of cash flow into the Bank of America really take off that level. That's one of the metrics I use to buy.
Well, that's very simply, basically, Benjamin Graham at work, right? That's all about buying something at book value, maybe even looking at a Warren Buffett, I mean, who studied under him. But, you know, you look at buying something that is worth a very small, if not any multiple, above what is their breakup value, if you will, and therefore, what really risk do you have?
It's true. Yes, and it's 100% right. You know, you're looking at Graham, you're looking at Warren Buffett. But what's key is to avoid value traps. There has to be. I'm telling you because I operate in under 10 stocks, and I'm telling you because I unfortunately experienced this. And there's so many value traps out there. You have to have some kind of growth component. And for me, the large cap banks, they're shrinking, more regulation. But when you shrink an entire industry, it's always better for the large caps because you're actually telling all the mid caps you'll never, ever become a large cap ever. And everybody who wants to do business is going to do business with the four largest banks in the world. Maybe you can include, you know, U.S. Bank Corp in there as well. But it's creating four or five banks that are the king of the banking world, and nobody else will ever be able to enter that. So I think the growth catalyst, yes, everything's being, you're shrinking this entire industry, more regulation. They got to do what over the next 7-8 years, whatever it is. It's a good time frame.
Oh, with you're talking about the Basel rules were even postponed even further.
Yeah,
recently. Another reason I think the banks moved up higher.
And I love that rule because, and people say, well, you know, that's terrible, 7 years. Guys, if you do it in 2 years, you're going to force these guys to sell assets at prices that are at a rock bottom. At least they have a 7-year time frame to say, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to get the right price. But if you force an industry to sell some of its assets in a 18-month, 2-year time frame, you're going to crush the entire market. And remember, our banking system, a lot of people believe we're not going to have a good economy without the banking system. Without a strong banking system. So I love the time frame that they put. If you're a proponent of the stock market, if you really love stocks, if you want your stocks to go higher, it's very important that they put a long term time frame on this. If you're a perma bear, you're going to hate it, but I think it's very good. But if you're looking at the large cap banks, I just see that growth component where, you know, all the investment, you know, all the banking, everything that's going to be done. You're looking at Citigroup, the global, these guys are going to be able to expand much quicker globally as well because they have so much money. They're so big. I just think they have a huge competitive advantage over everybody else. And that's a growth component. And I combine that with buying these companies under tangible book value, and that's where I came to buying Citigroup.
Right. Now, one of the things that you haven't heard a lot about lately, you know, it was in the news and over and over and over, was Goldman Sachs. It's like the conversation about Goldman Sachs, good and bad, by the way. I mean, the conversation has kind of like disappeared. Have you noticed?
Yeah, I wish I worked at Goldman Sachs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, just to check out what the heck is going on, right?
It does. You know, you know everybody. You're guaranteed to make money on every single trade.
You know, you're going out to good dinners all the time. Yep, I'm here.
Everyone complains, and we all hate them, but we all want to work.
And then we'd also be a lot thinner than we are, right? And we'd have really nice suits.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no. To your point, yeah, Goldman. You're right, though. Goldman. That story disappeared from the news a little bit, and. Yeah, I mean, I really don't have anything to say about it because there's nothing that really hit the market about Goldman Sachs. But I don't know.
I mean, there's nothing. I mean, there's nothing good or bad.
No,
it's
amazing.
It's like nothing.
No, we have heard nothing about Goldman Sachs.
Nothing. I mean, it's incredible. Let's go back to the peripheral world outside now of China, outside the United States, Europe. We talked about. Let's talk about the emerging markets for a moment. India. Now, India, we really liked. We cut our position about, I don't know. I don't know the exact date. Maybe a month ago or something like that.
Did you used to buy India?
What?
How'd you buy
we
India?
Used IFN, the India ETF.
Okay.
There's a couple of them out there. We like that one, the Wisdom Tree India. And that one did tremendous. I mean, just absolutely on fire. And obviously, when you buy, by the way, I don't know if people know this, but when you buy an ETF, this is really important. When you buy an ETF of another country, for example, let's say I buy the ETF of India. There is not only the potential for appreciation or loss due to the fact that you're buying the India stock market or whatever's in the ETF, but you also have currency issues that you need to be aware of. So there are many times when you may have invested, for example, in a Japanese ETF, EWJ is one of them, and for example, the stock market in Japan went down, but all of a sudden your ETF went up because the yen went up against the dollar. So there's kind of a multifaceted, I don't know of any hedged dollar hedged ETFs out there on this. Maybe that's something we could think about talking about. But basically, you're dealing with currency issues, which obviously have also been very volatile lately. But India, we liked. You know, inflation is just out of control over there. They're raising rates again, and it seems like they're trying to slow down the economy. Taiwan, we really liked when they had the agreement with China with a lot more trade going through. Although we cut that on a dip down and actually came back up a bit. We also like Brazil for a while. We're out of that. We don't really have any significant on this side. We have some mutual funds on our global allocations in emerging markets, but looking at all of that, looking at the core companies like the like Brazil and the BRICS, if you will, and Russia, what's your feeling on those countries? Are they getting too much cash just thrown at them, or is this something we're going to continue also seeing some benefit from?
I think you're going to continue to see benefit from it. Look, just to give you some stats on China. For people who've never been to China, have never been to India, if you just read the headlines, you hear, you know, China just passed Japan as the second largest economy. They're going to be, you know, largest economy in the world. And people, I think, are under the assumption, at least I was before I went to China, that, you know, China is kind of similar to the U.S. in some areas. It's going to be huge. Guys, they're not even close to us. I mean, they're upgrading from bicycles to these tiny cars that I couldn't even fit in. 30%.
You could if you worked at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, I don't even know if I can. I know, right? But I'm lucky if I get my leg in. Hopefully, no one saw me. I felt like doing radio on TV more. But if you're looking at the internet, 32% of the people in China are on the internet. Only 32%. What is it? 75-80%. In the U.S., if you're looking at 50% of the population is still farmers. So if you're looking at the growth, it's absolutely enormous still. I mean, you know, you're comparing it still. They're in like the 70s, the 60s, and the 70s.
No, they're going, through the agricultural age to the Industrial Revolution there is really what's happening. That's exactly what's happening.
And you have to play the key trends, because if you look at it, you know, what you're doing, you're looking at Brazil being a, you know, agriculture nation. You look at China agriculture, and now that they're becoming industrialized, well, one, you know, you look at certain, you know, you look at the big themes. You look at, well, pollution is absolutely insane in China. It's absolutely insane in India. Also, if you're looking on the agricultural level, places where they used to, feed their people, and their arable land is disappearing because they get paid more for having buildings on there than producing crops, which is why fertilizer companies have been so on fire, you know, not just, you know, over the last like 10 years or so to 15 years. You look at potash and where it's come, it's off its high. But still, if you're looking at some of the themes taking place, you know, alternative energy areas where, you know, of course, a lot of money losing companies, you want to look at the emerging market and see what themes are working and what themes are going to take place over the next decade. And if you're looking at like things to control pollution, if you're looking at you know, the agriculture theme, you know, just so many themes taking place, infrastructure that's taking place, commodities that are taking place. I mean, infrastructure commodities, I think we're at the low end. But I think if we're looking at agriculture, there's a lot of great plays. If you're looking at alternative energy companies that make money, guys, because there's a lot of alternative energy companies that are absolutely terrible that need, you know, to get paid by Spain and Germany to actually survive. No, there's a lot of companies out there in alternative energy that are making money that can benefit from China, benefit from India and emerging markets. So that's the way to play it. But yeah, that's where the growth is. And look, that's where the big money's going too.
So Frank, I'm going to give you an idea, and something we've talked about before, and I'm going to give a homework assignment to my listeners here, and I want your homework assignment to be sent to me. You can send anything to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Don't worry, I won't laugh. I won't be mean. I'm a nice guy. Anything you want to send me, you can always send me. But here's the homework assignment. There is this, we agree, there's an industrial revolution that's happening in a variety of countries. That means a lot of things. One of the things that it means, and you and I talked about this, and I didn't get to that article, and I'm sorry, was what were the effects of some of this beyond just the idea of roads and infrastructure and wealth, et cetera? Well, one of the things that there was a really fascinating study done on recently was that India and a few other countries, but India in particular, the diabetes level, the rate of diabetes is off the chart. Like 1 in 7 have diabetes. The amputations last year were like 260,000 amputations. I think that's the number, due to diabetes. The ability to get drugs to control it is just a problem because they're expensive and people don't have the money. Why is this? Well, they're going from a nation that was built on, they were poor and a lot of malnutrition for expecting mothers. And I guess the body, goes through the process of adapting to what is out there, and they didn't require as much protection against sugars, et cetera, and that kind of thing. So what happened is they passed it on generation to generation, and we know how that goes. And what happened is that their bodies are unable to really put up with the more westernized style of eating, the amount of eating, the style of eating, the way we eat, and what's happening there and how they've gone through things. And the diabetes level is just off the chart. The question is then, if that is the case there and other places, what can be done? What are the companies that can benefit? I mean, I'm sorry to, you know, let's state there's a horrible situation. Okay, I got that. We understand that. It's horrible. But Are there companies out there that can help the circumstance that are maybe either in the development stage or possibly in the generic, in the distribution? Who is involved in the diabetes medication and the solution for emerging markets, to look at as companies? You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I can get you started on that. I've done research on this before. I mean, if you look at China, China has 100 million people in China have diabetes. I think it's something like 50 million in India. It might be more, though, based on your statistics. And I think only 20 million in the U.S. But, these are coming off the top of my head. I think it's West Pharmaceutical. DaVita, Frenzius Medical Care. I've done a lot of research on this on companies that could actually play for those markets. But I love that theme. I think it's a fantastic theme. You could go, safe and recommend, the West Pharmaceuticals, the Dickinson and some of the higher name companies. Or you may want to go into the biotech area, because that's where, the enormous returns are. But yeah, I really like that theme.
Yeah, and the biotechs are actually something that we really like. There's a few of them that we've been looking at. It's hard to really evaluate a biotech that does not have a steady stream of income, because now you're just dealing with trial basis issues and hopeful sentiment. And if something breaks through, there's big money in that. But the question is, you also have failures in that area as well. So, if it doesn't really have a track record, it's hard to take a look at. You can look at the ETF, that's the biotech ETF, et cetera. But I think that that's something that really will be a theme in 2011 and forward that we're going to be looking at in terms of how that will benefit from much of the worldwide growth out there. All right, so let's wrap this up. What else do you see in the next couple of minutes, really quickly? Do you see any other themes? I mean, do you see that the M&A activity is going to continue to be very strong next year?
Yeah, I think it does. But one theme I'll share with you right now is tablets. I think it's going to be enormous. I don't think the growth story in tech is cloud computing next year. I think it's going to be tablets. And I'm not talking about the iPad. iPad is the high-end tablet. I'm talking about every single company, which tens of billions of dollars on their balance sheet. They're all getting into the tablet industry. And I think the lower-end tablet industry, it's really, if you look at the numbers, it's going to be enormous. But I think it's going to come to the point where the laptop is not going to exist anymore in 5 to 7 years from now. Everyone's going to have a laptop. I just bought an iPad. It's unbelievable. I'm using all the time. I don't use my laptop anymore. But
wait. Back up. Talk to me about typing, because one of the things I do with my laptop is yeah. But what I do a lot of blog posts and stuff like that on my laptop.
I've never made one mistake, and I've been typing on it for the past 3 weeks. I haven't made one mistake typing. It picks it up easily. If you're typing 20,000 words a month, which is probably about 4% of the population out there, it might not be good. Of course, I'm on my computer and I'm writing newsletters all day. But when you're searching anything that you would use, if you're typing 20,000 words on a laptop too, I usually like to really sit down at my computer and actually do that. But
there's also external keypads. As a matter of fact, one of the companies that we like that has been very volatile, and it's something that we have a small position in, is Zagg, Z-A-G-G. I talked to you about this. I mean, it's very volatile, very aggressive play. But one of the things that they have, a lot of the products that are associated with laptops and iPhones and BlackBerries and all that, they have this really cool thing that I was looking at. They have it's like a case sort of, but it has a Bluetooth keyboard or something like that built in for the iPad. It's kind of cool. You know what I mean? So it's almost like, if you think about it for a second, an iPad or a tablet with a keyboard essentially is a notebook.
Yeah, basically. I really don't see it. Once you type and once you get it, I don't see people actually buying that product, to be honest. I wouldn't buy it. I think typing on it is very simple, and I have very big fingers. But my point real quick, I know we're running late here, is it's almost like you're able to buy Qualcomm. Remember, Qualcomm is more a play on lower-end phones, and in 1997, 98, the stock's trading under 4, and it's 50 now. I think that you're going to be able to buy a lot of companies, maybe the component makers for tablets, at very, very cheap prices, but in the lower and tablets, not necessarily. Everyone focuses on the iPad and breaking down the iPad, what's in the iPad. I think the tablet market's going to explode next year. I think every company, Hewlett Packard, you're going to see every place, just like you see iPhones. I think it's going to be huge.
Yep. Frank Curzio, Stansberry and Associates. He writes a couple of great newsletters you need to check out. Always, we'll have the links on our website at thedisciplineinvestor.com. You can just check out the show notes, and you can find out more information about the things that he writes and what he does, and all the things that he's thinking about. And clearly, if there was an award, you would get the award for the favorite guest of the year, Frank. How do you like
I don't
that?
Know about that? I don't know about that, but I really appreciate that.
Well, maybe not my favorite, but at least a listener's favorite.
I know, right? You talk about the whole friend introduction. I was like, are we friends now?
Yeah, well, and clearly not your wife's favorite person to listen to either, by the way, but obviously for the listeners it is.
That's really cool. I want to wish everyone out there happy holidays.
All right, Frank Curzio, we'll see you soon. We'll figure out what happens, and once the year starts, we'll get back to, okay, what is the themes? What are the themes? What is going to happen moving forward? Frank Curzio, thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Thanks, bud.
Hey, and everybody, thanks for joining me. Again, any questions, anything you want to ask me, anything you want to talk about, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We're going to be back after the first of the year. Don't worry about it. And we're going to have lots more great guests. Jim Rogers is lined up. We also have, of course, Mr. Griffin, who wrote that great book about the Fed, is lined up, and all sorts of other guests that will bring us some timely and interesting topics. Thanks again for being there. Have a happy and a healthy holiday with your family. Love to all. See you real soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.